Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on this week's programme.
You move into this respectful space, which means you, yes, you can play and you can go to a funeral. It's a respectful mood, but also a mood of celebration.
How do cities plan for the afterlife? On this week's show, we dig deep into death and urban living. From places where real estate for the dead is almost as expensive as for the living, to a modernist approach to the traditional cemetery. We also hear about the importance of archaeology in cities such as London, and much, much more. All coming up right here on The Urbanist with the very much alive Andrew Tuck. The dead may never rest peacefully in Hong Kong, where niches and burial plots are as hard to come by as affordable housing in one of the world's most expensive cities. The starting price of a niche at a private columbarium is around £20,000. That's, I guess, €23,000. But even with a spot secured, bodies have to be relocated every 4 years to free up space for the growing population of the dead. Car Wong is the founder of the boutique funeral company White Lily and an expert on Hong Kong's real estate for the dead. Monocle's Karina Choi sat down with Car Wong, founder of the boutique funeral company White Lily and an expert on Hong Kong's real estate for the dead.
White Lily is a very unique funeral service company in Hong Kong. So what we specialize are a few things. Number one, we do personalized funerals. And in Hong Kong, it's very rare. Most of the funerals are done as cookie cutter product, and it's not very personalized, meaning that, you know, you go to one, you go to second, or you go to third one, and they all feel and look the same, and you don't know, you switch the picture, and it will be the same funerals. But what we do is we try our best to help clients personalize the funerals so that they can send off their loved ones differently in their own way. Everybody's unique, we believe, and they deserve their own funerals. And second, also very important, is we hold most of the funerals at churches. And in Hong Kong, that's also close to impossible. And we're the first one who does it, and we probably maybe the only one still doing it. I think, you know, regarding the final resting place for the body in Hong Kong, because of the space limitation, the options are limited. And so our job is to help them to get the best option, to help the families get the best option possible, even though they are limited. For example, probably over 90% of the bodies were cremated because there's just no space. But then after the bodies cremated, we still have to decide where to put them. And in Hong Kong, there are a lot more ashes waiting to be put up in the columbarium or niches than they're available. To help the families figure out the options is part of our difficulties.
And so what is the current state of Hong Kong's real estate for the dead?
So right now, burial plots in Hong Kong are super rare. Like I said, it's more than, I would say more than 95% of the people are cremated. So for burial plots, even within burial plots, the few burial plots that we have, most of them, the family has to exhume the body after a few years. So actually, permanent plots are extremely rare. 99.9% of the people will not have that option. So when a family decides what to do with the bodies, if they want a burial, they also have to decide whether they want to have the body exhumed in a few years, usually about 7. And if not, then the long-term permanent burial plots are very expensive. So it ranges, and a lot of them have limitations, for example, the faith of the deceased. Even though they are available, they're in the millions, talking about maybe 3 to 5 million for some of the plots. For the ones to exhume after 7 years, for the government ones, actually it's quite cheap. It's only a few thousand dollars. But some other plots, maybe at the range of 10,000 or so. But then in 7 years, you have to take the body up again and again find a way to dispose it. Then the second natural way to do it is to put it in the niche. But then in Hong Kong right now, the niches are not available. Now, There are a few options in terms of columbariums. The government has columbariums, and the government columbariums are really nicely built, the new ones, and also quite reasonable. For a few $1,000, you can have it done. The problem is it's not available. There's none available. So in the meantime, people, while they wait, they have to store it somewhere, and a lot of them are stored at the government temporary storage. And they wait for years before they can have the ashes put place in the government columbarium. And usually after a lucky draw type selection process when they can get a spot. Now there are private ones, but in 2017, the government passed a regulation of columbarium for the first time. So now originally those columbarium that were there then, they will all have to reapply for the license. So all of them right now are pretty much under the application process. So for the past 2 years, no commercial columbariums was available for families to put their ashes. So until the new batches of commercial columbariums got their license, families will have to wait again. Now the private ones, once they get the new license, you can expect the price to go up too, because now they're all legal and legitimate. And even before they were legal and legitimate, the price range was from maybe $50,000 to maybe $500,000 easily. So it's not a lot of options right now.
So I'm sure you've seen ads all over the city promoting a so-called green burial, where locals are encouraged to scatter their ancestors' ashes either in the Victoria Harbour or at these designated gardens provided by the government to save money and space. Do you think this method will gain popularity over the next few years, or do you think that the Chinese are still concerned with following certain customs?
I think it is gaining up popularity. And I just remember about 5 years ago, a small percentage of my clients would choose to scatter ashes. But right now, actually, the percentage has gone up quite a bit. And it is not really related to whether they have money or they don't have money. I think this is just a simple, convenient, and the cleanest way to do it right now. So for scattering ashes, they do have a choice of scattering in not exactly Victoria Harbour, but further out, because the government designated a few areas for the families to scatter. And the Garden of Remembrance, of course, that's also available. Now, when you scatter in these places, you can still have a plaque made. So it's kind of a place for worship for the Hong Kong people. The tradition and culture of keeping a body is slowly being broken and removed by the government. And I think it's gonna get more popular as time goes by. The latest news of the government columbarium is not permanent anymore. So in every few years, you have to renew and pay again. So I think in general, government is pushing slowly the public to move into scattering more green burial.
Typically, when you have clients come in, are they aware of their options and what to do? And are they aware that they are facing high costs and lack of space in Hong Kong?
I think in general, they are aware that there will be issues. And in general, I think a lot of people talk about it, but they do not know the options and really a lot of the detailed information. I think one reason is that the Chinese, culturally, they don't like to talk about death. So they don't pay attention to the detail of these matters, or they actually purposely try to stay away. So most of my clients, when they walk through the doors, they do not know what options they would, and they rely on me to guide them through the options and how to make those decisions.
A report there by Monocle's Karina Choi in Hong Kong. When we think of archaeologists, we often imagine characters such as Indiana Jones working in the desert and uncovering mummified skeletons or dinosaurs. But in reality, archaeologists are just as much at home in our urban environments and play an extremely important role in the design and development of our cities. Any place where there's been human settlement for hundreds or thousands of years will inevitably have human remains hidden beneath the surface. These are frequently unearthed when construction or exploration works occur, as was the case in 2012, when the remains of England's King Richard III were located beneath a car park in the city of Leicester. Archaeological finds, whether unexpected or not, can lead to construction delays whilst remains are assessed and removed from the site, and this can cost thousands and thousands of pounds to developers. Monocle's Nick Manise caught up with Louise Fowler, an archaeologist from the Museum of Archaeology London, to learn more about the role that they play.
Human remains would form part of the archaeological remains that we work with, which are protected in England through the planning system. They'd be considered to be part of the historic environment. And before any work takes place on a construction project, we'd look at what had previously been found in an area in order to get an idea of what might be found. So in the case of human remains and burial grounds, we've got a pretty good idea of where these were located within the city, certainly for the historic burial grounds, which might be recorded on maps. And for earlier burials, we know where we found Roman or Saxon burials. We know where those remains tend to be found.
So once you do find these remains or you discover these remains, what's the process or what sort of work are you doing with them once you've dug them up?
With human remains, once we find them on site, we know that they're going to be there, so we've planned the work. So one site that we worked on quite recently was the site of the Royal London Hospital in Whitechapel. We were working within a 19th century burial ground there that was attached to the hospital. And that burial ground was located just right next to some of the hospital wards. And so where we were working had to be screened from public view while we were carrying out the work. And we would expose, carefully record using photography and drawing all of the remains that were present, and then we would lift them and they would come back to the office for our osteologists to work on.
And in terms of sites where you unexpectedly find remains, what happens there?
If they're not at all expected on the site and we do come across human remains during our work, we have to stop work.
Have you been called in where developers or builders have started on a project and then unexpectedly found some remains?
Occasionally, in a city like London, there's so many people who have lived in London and died in London over the 2,000 years of its existence. There are remains that we don't know about, and occasionally they do come up on construction projects that are not programmed in to be archaeological excavations. And in those cases, sometimes the developers will contact the police if they find human remains on site. That's what they should be doing. And the police might contact us to visit the site to advise on the likely date of the remains and to confirm that they're not suspicious.
Well, that's probably a good thing. And construction completely stops on the site.
In order to excavate, yes, they would need to secure a licence from the Ministry of Justice. So, yeah.
When you're working with architects and designers, do unexpected finds ever change the direction of the design or the work that they're doing?
Yes, they sometimes do. So, sort of moving slightly away from human remains, it's always assumed that it's better to preserve archaeological remains in situ. So sometimes if we find remains that are particularly significant that we do want to preserve in place, then there might be changes to a design. So we've recently been working on the site of Bloomberg's new European headquarters in the City of London. And on that site, there's a Roman temple dedicated to the god Mithras that was found in the 1950s. And when it was found, it was removed from the location where it was found and rebuilt at street level and opened up in the 1960s. And as part of the work that we were planning to do on the site, we were working with Bloomberg to take apart that 1960s reconstruction and move it back to the location where the temple was found. But when we started to excavate trial trenches before that work took place, we found foundations of the temple that hadn't been moved in the 1950s. They were still there and they had to be preserved. We couldn't build the new reconstruction directly on top of them. So we had to adjust the plans for the foundations of the new building so that they could bridge over those surviving remains and preserve them in situ. So it was quite a big change to the design.
that's probably a great example of opportunities and design opportunities created by these archaeologically rich sites in the city. Are there other benefits from working in these sorts of environments where there is a lot of history and remains and buildings left in the ground?
Yeah, there are huge benefits. So that site, that example there, the Temple of Mithras, is open to the public now and people can visit it and it's free to visit. So we also were carrying out an excavation as part of that project too, and we found a huge wealth of finds from 1st and 2nd centuries of Roman London, basically. And some of those finds are also on display on that site, so people can visit and see them. So it's a really great opportunity for bringing the past to people that they can visit.
And then why are these discoveries important to cities and why do we need to treat them with care?
So archaeology and archaeological remains are hugely important. They can tell us things that history doesn't tell us. And there's a famous archaeologist called Ivan Olhume who said in the 1960s that archaeology was the handmaiden of history. So he sort of saw it as having this secondary role as sort of filling in the gaps that history didn't tell us about. But I think it's more than that, really, because it can tell us about the lives of people who weren't recorded by history at all, the sort of anonymous pasts, the pasts of people who were poor, people who were slaves, women, children, and things that we absolutely don't know from history. And it can also help to challenge some of the assumptions that we have from historical evidence. So in the case of the Royal London Hospital, we wouldn't have known about how the burial ground there was being used if it wasn't for the archaeological dig, because the burial ground was located just to the south of the hospital's medical school, and it was being used for the burial of remains that had been dissected within the medical school, as well as for the burial of patients who had died within the hospital. So those burials, according to the hospital's records, were being carried out in secret. So we wouldn't have known exactly what was going on there unless we had the archaeological remains and a really close reading of the documentary sources as well to understand that site. So I think archaeology can really help us to understand how the world that we're in today came about.
Archaeologist Louise Fowler there, in conversation with Monocle's Nick Manise. When we think about a cemetery or graveyard, it often comes to mind either as a site that is far away from the city centre or a medieval one within it. So we were curious to learn more about modern approaches to these final resting places. One such example is the Boonwurrung Memorial Park in Melbourne, designed by the architecture practice Aspect Studios. This is a functioning cemetery like any other, but is intended for everyday use, with a playground, fountain and cafe in tow. Curious? Well, Monocle's Carlotta Ribello caught up with Kirsten Bauer, the director of Aspect Studios, a little bit earlier on to find out more.
Boonwurrung Memorial Park is a large-scale base cemetery project or cemetery site. It's about 35 kilometres from central Melbourne. The cemetery started in around 1996, so it's a young cemetery, but what happened was, is even though it's quite young, about 10 years ago, they realised that they had to actually change fundamentally the type of cemetery it was. So that's when they started a whole process of sort of reinventing, as they say, or as they say, demystifying what the cemetery can be for that community. And the cemetery itself, or the memorial park, because they don't like to use the word cemetery, you know, the whole principle behind this project is to be talking it as a memorial park. So cemetery is, in a sense, I suppose, reduced in the formality of the park. And this memorial park sits in a really strange part of Melbourne. It sits on the edge of a residential area, and then beyond it is more of a regional rural environment. So part of its identity is how does it try to connect to quite a dispersed sort of residential community. So it doesn't sit in the middle of like a really dense residential area, but it's a growing area. The cemetery guys always talk about, when we talk about population and demographics, they talk about the future death demographics, not the future growth demographics. So it's really quite entertaining. And in a sense, the death growth area is in this particular part of Melbourne.
Can you describe then how people can use this site and what are its functions other than just memorializing the dead?
Yeah, sure. It's about a 100-hectare site, and we were involved very much in the first stage, which is around 20 acres or 20 hectares. So the main project was, as I say, to demystify. So they wanted to change the communities and the public's perception of why go to this place. So they were more interested in creating a place that people would come to on an everyday basis. So rather than a memorial tradition, I suppose, where you come on Mother's Day or you go on the death of your loved one or you go for a funeral, that it would become a place you could go on a daily basis. So that was the fundamental shift they wanted to do, because the whole team was interested in what they say is it's celebrating life, not celebrating death. And the notion of celebrating life is how to bring people every day there. And that comes down to the things of, like, we've designed walking tracks, playgrounds, working with the architect that the buildings can be utilised not just for funerals but for weddings, bar mitzvahs, other kind of celebrations. They want to turn it into a sculptural park. They want to turn it into a cultural park. They want to turn it into an event space. So to that extent, they've even got, like, a cafe that anyone can come and visit next to the playground. And so all these things, I suppose, are shifting the typology and shifting the way people relate to that space.
Now, in the 19th century, cemeteries were treated like public parks. You'd have people that would do picnics on them and gather there. Is this then kind of a return to the cemeteries being seen as a social place?
I think so. I mean, in Australia, it's never really had that full social tradition, I think, that perhaps we understand that, you know, happens in sort of European environments. We've never really fully sort of embraced that as a large social space. We're part of that tradition, but we're not part of that tradition. And I think the reason why we don't have that tradition isn't as strong as in Australia, I suspect, and this is sort of a professional hunch, is we've always had lots of land. So the cemeteries are always constantly being pushed to the edges of the city. And so the requirement for the cemetery to perform more than just a place for memorialisation, you know, when you're in a more denser city, the requirement for different types of open space and the requirements for these kind of social spaces is more pressure around that. So then you start to occupy these kind of spaces. And that's kind of what's happening now. Some of our older cemeteries are slowly being reinvented into more public types of space, because now we're at a point where the population has grown and land is becoming more precious and significant. So therefore more programs are starting to enter the cemetery. So I think for us it's probably more of a later issue in terms of, I don't think we had the same sort of urban pressures as perhaps some of the European countries.
What is the mood for a space like this? You mentioned you have a playground on site. So how do you keep it respectful but active at the same time?
It's a very good question. We had many long conversations about this. So we actually had to map and think through, if people are coming for an everyday coffee and playground, what if they were coming to buy flowers to go and visit their loved one? What if they were coming in for a wedding? What if they were coming in for a funeral? What if they were coming in for a conference? And so we had to construct a very strong sort of entrance sequence that, in a sense, brought everyone together, but gave the cues about where you would go for different types of activities. And in a sense, we kind of learnt from quite a few projects in terms of, we created a very intimate threshold, which is this whole notion of leaving the context or leaving one particular world behind, and you come through a very narrow threshold, and then from there you kind of then open up into a new space. And I think the idea is through that threshold there's a sort of a moment of respect, and I think that then is in a sense a sort of a psychological outcome of the design, to sort of say you can't just run in, so to speak. You move into this respectful space, which means you can play and you can go to a funeral, but it's sort of ensuring it's a respectful mood, but also a mood of celebration. And that's what was trying to be achieved. And it seems to work. We've built a fountain as well that children play in, and no one has ever said that there's been disruption, which is interesting. You know, they haven't had that sort of jarring disruption between people on the playground, because kids come to funerals and things like that, so they need something to do. So it's actually kind of reduced conflict in some ways, because there's things for people to do in that environment.
For those buried in the woodlands, I was reading that the loved ones will be able to track the body by GPS, as trees are the location markers, kind of. How does that work in practice?
There's a few ways it works. One is you might have a GPS receptor. So buried in the ground close to the body is a sort of a GPS emitter or receptor. And every country has a different kind of policy or standard that you have to follow. i.e. you can't lose people. You know, in a sense, you're obliged as a memorial park to know where people are. So a lot of natural burials, they don't want a rock or a particular label of the person. You know, you are part of the woodland. So they're not seeking physical recognition of where the body is, and you are part of nature. And that's where the GPS tracker comes in, really importantly, because then that can be in the ground but not visible. But you can then still use it to ensure you don't forget where your loved one is. But also, obviously, the memorial park needs to know how many bodies so you don't bury someone on top of someone else. So that's where the GPS system comes in terms of ensuring, you know, you've got an accurate mapping of where people are. And then there's whole other systems that are coming about that are being explored even here at Bunurong, you know, like even QR codes and things like that. So, you know, if you're walking past the grave of your loved one, something might happen on your phone, and then a story comes up, or, you know, you hear them speak to you, or you have a connection with them. So they're starting to talk about, you know, virtual relationships with your loved ones as much as a physical connection with your loved one as well. So that's where the GPS thing works in another way as well.
That was the director of Aspect Studios, Kirsten Bauer, in conversation with our very own Carlotta Ribello. Now, as we have heard on today's show, cemetery plots within city boundaries are hot property no matter where they are in the world. Couple that with a surrounding housing shortage and a protected ecological landscape, and the fight for space only magnifies. Such is the case for New Zealand's biggest and arguably most storied site, Waikemete Cemetery in Auckland. We enlisted the help of our resident Kiwi, David Stevens, to tell us more.
Waikemete Cemetery is New Zealand's largest. Occupying 108 hectares in the middle of the suburb of Gleneden in Auckland, it's the final resting place for over 70,000 people, each with their own unique experience of the land they chose to return to. It's also home to New Zealand's largest war grave, as well as an urupa for Māori burials and memorials to tragedies that struck the country, such as the Erebus plane crash and the 1918 influenza epidemic. It even has a subdivision dubbed Dali Alley, housing mausoleums for some of the region's most prolific winemaking families. The site's stories could go on forever, but recent estimates have found that its service as a cemetery perhaps may not. Plots are on course to fill up in the next 3 to 4 years, and with that, the history of the city and its people is also set to stall. So why not expand? Well, despite the fact that Waikemete exists in a relatively dense area of the city, its efforts to grow are hampered on two main fronts. Firstly, Auckland is suffering a well-documented housing shortage, and more space for the dead would mean less space for the living. Cemeteries also require flat land with good links to public transport, exactly the things vital to housing development. But perhaps the bigger issue here is the ecological one. Waikemete is as much a public green space as it is a place for those who have passed. And among that green space exists vast areas of gum trees. These areas were declared protected under the Auckland Unitary Plan in 2015. Experts argued that the areas were important for supporting indigenous vegetation and signed off on widening the areas of protection, which overlapped the very sites by which the cemetery had hoped to grow. This year, an Environment Committee meeting identified two new zones that were approved for consultation on potential development, but action is needed fast. The city's other two major cemeteries are due to be full up by 2050 at the latest. Burial traditions haven't helped ease the demand either. Auckland's population diversity is only growing, and that growth has welcomed more cultures who prefer burials over cremation. But rituals will have to change as populations continue to rise. Efforts like eco-burials, where family members are given GPS coordinates for the unmarked space where their loved one's biodegradable casket was lowered, are starting to pick up. And the use of public mausoleums or smaller plots for ash scattering are other ways these cemeteries can maximise on space. Whatever happens, this piece of land will forever tell the stories of the people laid to rest here. It just may be that this story in particular is nearing its conclusion.
Well, that was David Stevens, our resident Kiwi, and also this show's editor. And that's all for this week's very somber episode of The Urbanist. We hope you dug it. This show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, it has research by Nick Manise, and it was edited by David Stevens. And to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, well, here's Black Keys with dead and gone. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.